All right. Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Sahaviryan Karavavahai, Tejasvinavadhi Tamastu Mavit. Vishavahai Om Shanti 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 Tanyam Sarvagam Sarvam Sarvabhuta Guhashayam Yat Sarva Vishayatitam Tasmai Sarvavide Namaha. Good. Nice to see you all today, and welcome also to many students who are taking these classes online. We continue with our study of this brilliant text of Sri Shankara, Upadesha Sahasri. In our last class, we had an extensive topic about an extensive discussion about a topic that's very important, though a little bit technical, in a scholarly sense, and that was a discussion about the pramanas. Pramana, as we said, in our Vedantic context, does not mean merely an authority, as it does in Hindi. It means specifically a means of knowledge, an instrument through which you can gain knowledge, like your five senses, including sight. We call that pramana pratyaksha. It is a means for gaining knowledge of the world around us, the tangible world around us. There are parts of the world that we can't see. Have you ever seen an atom? Not individually. Right now you're looking at a bunch of atoms, but you can't make out an individual atom. How do we know they exist? Well, science, which makes plenty of use of anumana inference, including mathematics. So, and the classical example is not atoms, but rather when you see smoke rising above the mountain, you don't see the fire, but you can infer the presence of fire. That is anumana. And this discussion was really for the sake of setting up the main pramana we use in the study of Advaita Vedanta, I should say the process of self-inquiry. Can you appreciate why? There's too many people study Vedanta as a subject matter. We're not engaged in that kind of academic study. We're engaged in a process of self-inquiry. So to guide that process of inquiry, we need a pramana, a means through which we can discover one's true self as Satchidananda Atma. We call that pramana shabda. Words, the words of our scriptures, the words of the ancient rishis, the words of enlightened ones. So we use all these pramanas in our daily life, and we especially rely on shabda pramana in our process of self-inquiry. That pretty much summarizes that real technical class that we had last time. Those six pramanas that we discussed broadly can be reduced to these three. These would be the three main pramanas: pratyaksha, sense perception; anumana, inference; and shabda, words. You can honestly forget the others. These are the three we really need to remember. Now, in our discussion today, Shankara goes off extending on that topic, and he responds to a question: what happens when pramanas don't work? Is it possible for a pramana not to work? It happens. Let's start with pratyaksha, eyesight. Just coincidentally, Vasanti, whom you all know, is in India right now taking care of her 85, 86, I forget how old her mother is, quite old. And she's mother is about to get cataract surgery. common surgery, and nothing, not anything especially large, but good for a daughter to be there to take care of mother. Anyway, so mother has eyes. Can she see? Yeah. To some extent, you can appreciate the fact that a cataract is an obstacle or impediment for the function of the sense of sight. All of our senses can have certain impediments. It can be hard of hearing, etc., etc. When you get a cold, you notice you can't taste very well when you're congested. Anyway, pratyaksha is subject to impediments. So is anumana. Different kind, each, we should make it very clear, each pramana, not surprisingly, is subject to different kinds of impediments. So anumana, inference, is subject to different kinds of impediments. For example, what they call hetu abhasa, technical term, don't worry about it. It means misunderstanding that upon which the inference is based. You see smoke and you conclude there's fire. Suppose it's not really smoke. Early morning mist. You have misidentified that, in technical terms, hetu. And misidentifying the mist as smoke leads you to a wrong inference, which means the pramana fails to give correct knowledge. So pratyaksha can fail to give correct knowledge when it has an impediment. Anumana can fail to give correct knowledge when it has an impediment. What about shabda? Does shabda have any impediments? Many. Starting with being hard of hearing. Of course, yeah, that's really not correct, because being hard of hearing is really for the power of being hard of hearing is a matter of pratyaksha, not shabda. But you've all been listening to Advaita Vedanta for a long time. This is not an introductory class, so I know you've been listening to these teachings for a long time. My anniversary talk at Arshavidya Gurukulam, my anniversary talk, I took up the question, so are you enlightened yet? I can ask you that question. You've been listening to these times. So are you enlightened yet? And here comes an inference. The inference is, the fact that you're sitting here implies inferentially, because if you were enlightened, you could still come and enjoy these classes, but you wouldn't have a need to come and attend these classes. So by inference, I would assume that most of you perhaps are not yet enlightened. Why? Shabda Pramana. And in fact, in quite a powerful manner, because we are able in these classes to go to the direct source material, not the Upanishads, in this case Shankara's teachings, which are based on the Upanishads, see the original material in the original language and understand it thoroughly. You don't often get a chance to do that. Most Vedantic teachings are kind of fuzzy to me. Fuzzy, indistinct. They're teaching Vedanta, but not with clarity. We have an opportunity in these classes to go into these teachings with tremendous clarity about exactly what did those ancient rishis mean, exactly what is Shankara telling us here. We can get that. You get that from these classes. Now, my job is to do as much as I can so that you can get it. But notice, even when the Shabda Pramana is wielded, to use my guru's expression, when this means of knowledge is wielded with some skill, as I try to do, even then it doesn't always work. Why? varieties of impediments. And we'll see in the next class, Shankara starts to talk about those impediments to the operations of Shabda Pramana. Chitte hya darshavat yasmat, chitte hya darshavat yasmat, chudde vidya prakashate, chudde vidya prakashate, yamairnit yaischa yagnyaischa, yamairnit yaischa yagnyaischa, tapo bhistasya shodhanam, tapo bhistasya shodhanam. Chitte hi shuddhe, breaking the words apart and connecting them. Chittehi, indeed, when the chitta, when the mind, shuddhe, that ch is due to grammar rules, shuddha, you know the word, pure. So when the mind is shuddha, when the mind is pure, how pure? He gives a common example, adarshavat, like a mirror. So when the mind is pure like a mirror, vidya, knowledge, discovery of your true nature as Satchidananda Atma, prakashate shines, literally, knowledge shines, knowledge takes place in the mind when the mind is pure. And the mind being pure, pure here means, we've talked about this before, purity is not the presence of something, right? Purity is the absence of something. Pure water means what? Do you add it? How is this? What do you have to add to water to get it to be pure? It's not a matter of adding anything. It's a matter of removing the impurities. So here, what is a shuddha chitta, a pure mind? It's not a mind that you've added anything to. It's a mind that's been freed from some kind of impurity. In our current context, the impurities we're talking about are those impediments. There are so many, and this could be a week's worth of daily classes. So let me just identify some of the main impediments that actually Shankara addresses in the second half. So one impediment would be being extrovert, as most people are. Most people look for happiness, contentment, peace, etc., through their worldly activities. Being extrovert is an example of an impediment. So if you are most, and of course, it's not that someone, you know, I'm pausing because many people seem to have a bad habit of going to extreme positions, like I just did when I said everyone. Everyone is a word that suggests an extreme position. So I withdrew the word. Our topic here is that many people are subject to this problem of using extreme positions. He's an extrovert. He's an introvert. Those are extreme positions. Most people lie someplace in between these two extremes. And the point I'm making is you attending these classes, you may be quite introspective, not introverted, that's a different word, but quite introspective. Otherwise, I don't think these teachings would appeal to you much. But it doesn't mean you're completely free of extroversion. But when you see those sweets sitting out, they look so attractive, that's extroversion. That's looking at those sweets as a source of happiness. I will enjoy eating those sweets. When you know the true source of that enjoyment comes from within. If the true source of enjoyment comes from within, why should you trouble your body by putting more sugar and fat and other things in it? Stop! Well, that's the problem of extroversion. So even though you may have that introspective perspective. To say, even though you have that orientation, you're not free from that extroversion. It hangs on for a long time. That is an obstacle to the Shabda Pramana doing its job. Another example, I'll take them in order. Lack of Shraddha. Lack of Shraddha means lack of Shraddha. And Shraddha not in the sense of blind faith. We've discussed this many times. Shraddha meaning having sufficient trust that these teachings are indeed capable of leading you to the end of the road, the highest goal. And you have a right to have that lack of trust. As I said before, you've been coming to these classes a long time. You're still coming. So it's not unusual for that lack of trust to arise. That lack of trust is lack of Shraddha. It too is a huge impediment to the function of the Shabda Pramana. And the last one, and I said there are many, but we'll just talk about three. The last one, and these are, by the way, these are three of the biggest ones, I would suggest, even though there are many more, these would be three primary obstacles. And the last one that we'll discuss here is preconceived notions. Over the years, you have picked up, and especially before coming to this tradition of Advaita Vedanta, you've all picked up a lot of other teachings that have different conclusions, make different arguments, and fill your minds with lots of wrong notions. We'll call these preconceived because you have these wrong notions before you come to the teachings of Advaita Vedanta. Some of those preconceived notions are very deeply rooted. For example, at my talk at Arshavidya, I talked about enlightenment as an event. One day, I got it. And there is a moment of getting it, but that moment is not exactly what we mean by enlightenment. Anyway, that's not our topic today. That talk, by the way, is on our website. It's a good talk. You might find it useful if you haven't already seen it. As I said before, the topic was, are you enlightened yet, was the message of that talk. So, preconceived notions are another very difficult impediment to overcome. So what, as long as impediments, not just these three, the list goes on and on and on, and all of those form obstacles to the operation of this pramana, to this teaching being, this teaching has the capacity to lead you to the precipice of self-discovery. Notice I said precipice because the teachings can't do it for you. I can't do it for you. Shankara can't do it for you. You have to see. My teacher used an example of this. A doctor can, since we're talking about cataracts, suppose a doctor removes the cataracts and you're laying there with your bandages on and you say, "Doctor, you've removed my cataracts. You've removed the obstacle. So can I see now?" Your eyes are still bandaged. The doctor can remove the cataracts. You have to open your eyes and see. So it's not up to the doctor to do that. You have to see. That's why I said these teachings can lead you to the precipice of discovery. You have to see. You have to make that discovery. So how can we remove these impediments? Very conveniently, Shankara gives in brief some hints. This is a huge topic. Shankara himself deals with it only briefly here in two verses, so we'll keep our discussion short. So what advice does he say? In the last line, he says, "Tasya shodhanam." Tasya means manasaha, of the mind, of the chitta. Purification should, shodhanam, purification, tasya, of the mind. Purification of the mind is accomplished how? He gives three examples. For the three examples I gave, he gives three solutions. He says, yamaihi, through restraints. And this word can be understood in so many ways. Here, let us take it in the sense of restraining your mind at the time of meditation. Meditation is one of the best ways to remove impediments to the functioning of the Shabda Pramana. Specifically, we said earlier the problem was extroversion, not consistently looking inside yourself for the source of contentment, but rather looking outside yourself for the sake of contentment. That kind of extroversion. Well, meditation is the best solution to that problem. Yeah. Every time you meditate, you have an opportunity again and again to just rest in the peace and contentment that is your true nature. When your mind becomes quiet, you're there. That's all you have to do. Make the mind quiet. Yama, restraining the activities of the mind for the sake of meditation. Meditation, if you were to ask me what is the most important practice for preparing the mind, without a question, I would say meditation. Notice, we've made the point many times before, meditation itself won't make you enlightened. But meditation is the most effective, is one of the most important means of removing those obstacles. Then, next solution Shankara proposes is nityaihi yajnaihi. Nitya here meaning daily. Daily and yajna, rituals. Daily rituals. Of course, he's referring to, remember Shankara wrote this some 1200 years ago. So he's referring to the daily yajna, like Agnihotra, that was done by pious Hindus in those days. We don't do those rituals anymore, that's fine. But some kind of daily prayer and worship is an extremely powerful way of removing obstacles. This is where bhakti walks in the door. Again, I've said bhakti alone won't make you enlightened, but without bhakti, you won't get enlightened. So it has a similar role to meditation, and its role is in removing obstacles. And which obstacle? We can connect bhakti to this second obstacle I mentioned, which was lack of shraddha. When you engage in any kind of prayer or devotional activity, it connects you in a deeply emotional manner to this tradition, to the teachings of the ancient rishis, and especially connects you to, in an emotional manner, to Ishvara, to God. What better way to remove that lack of trust? When you use these teachings in a prayerful manner and find yourself connected to Ishvara, do you connect to Ishvara, or does Ishvara connect to you? Tagore put it in a nice way, Ishvara as though embraces you, which is nice. So yeah, we reach out in prayer and puja, but in return, we get, like in American culture, you get a big hug. How American. Big hugs. Nice. It's a wonderful aspect of American culture. Good. So, through any kind of devotional activity, you can remove this obstacle of lack of shraddha, lack of trust. Other ways as well, but we're just talking about this, we're taking this topic in a very broad way. And then the third And by the way, he says nitya means you can't reserve your bhakti for, suppose you go to a temple every Sunday evening. Well, once a week is good. It's just not enough. Nitya, every day, is what Shankara suggests. And then finally, he says, what else to do? The shodhana, the purification of the mind, removal of the impediments. The third one he gives, third means he gives, is tapo bihi tapas, through tapas. Tapas we generally understand as these austerities, like fasting, and I would take it almost in a more general way, effort. Let's stay with that. There are two ways of taking it. By the way, a very traditional way of taking tapas, and this is not my preferred way, but it is the most traditional way. How does tapas, how does fasting help you get enlightenment? Makes your body lighter. I've been using that joke lately. Enlightenment of the body through fasting. It works, what can you say? Anyway, a very traditional way of explaining that is through tapas, you willfully undergo suffering. And that suffering removes your bad karmas. Papa karmas. This is a very traditional way. And it's valid, 100% valid. I don't prefer it, but it's a 100% valid way of explaining. How does tapas work to purify you? It works by removing it. Every time you undergo some kind of suffering, papa karma gets expiated, so to speak, rubbed out, used up, well, is a better term. So to willingly and willfully undergo some kinds of suffering, as you do when you fast, that then removes some bad karmas, and papa karmas, bad, so-called bad karmas, absolutely an impediment, a very obvious impediment to enlightenment. That's a traditional metaphor, a traditional explanation, 100% valid, but how about if we could look at tapas also as this determination and effort, consistent effort, as you're all making. You know, every week you come to this class. You could be doing so many other things which are arguably more pleasant, like sleeping in on a Sunday morning. But you sacrifice that pleasant, you know, sleep in, have a late breakfast, whatever you like to do, or those of you watching online, you sacrifice other activities that you could be engaged in, and you dedicate, you commit yourself to this kind of Vedantic self-inquiry, these classes. So that's another way of understanding tapas. Traditional way, expiation of karmas, and a more modern interpretation might be committing yourself to this kind of effort. So, and that effort then would help remove that third category of obstacle. I said the three categories, just the main biggest three would be being extroverted, lack of shraddha, and the fourth I mentioned was having preconceptions. Those preconceptions, by the way, were gained through karma. Good karma or bad karma? These are misconceptions. You started off with the wrong teacher. We all start off with the wrong teacher. That happens to almost everyone. So due to lack of good karma or due to the presence of bad karma, you start off with the wrong teacher and your head gets filled with a lot of wrong conceptions, these preconceptions. We have to remove them. So the bad karma is removed by good karma, or bad karma is removed through the expiation of tapas, or to take my second interpretation, you have to make an effort to overcome those preconceptions. You have to recognize that you've been holding on. Nice American expression, we all have our pet ideas. These pet ideas are preconceptions. Some of them are right. Some of them are not right. But sometimes we don't re-examine our pet ideas, our preconceptions. That's where the problem lies. We have to re-examine them. So here we have talked about three possible impediments to the function of this pramana, shabda pramana, and three ways of resolving those impediments. So we continue with this topic in the next verse.
Shariraditapah kuryat, tadvishuddhyartham uttamam, mana adi samadhanam, tad deha vishoshanam.
Don't read it visheshanam, vishoshanam. Okay, we'll see that. Start in the third line. Mana adi. Looks a little funny when the word manas comes in a compound. The sakara drops. So the words become separate. It's actually part of a compound. Mana adi. The mind, etc. Samadhanam, the concentration of the mind, etc. Etc. would mean the concentration of the senses within, the withdrawal of the senses, and the focusing of the mind comes about how? Tad-tad-deha vishoshanam. Tad-tad-deha means each deha. How many dehas? Stula deha, one. Sukshma deha, two. And karana deha is not really a deha. So we'll just stay with these two, the subtle body and physical body. Stay with those two. Vishoshanam is actually drying out, and it refers to tapas. So you have to... What a funny thing. We use that term dry out when somebody is alcoholic. They need to dry out. Perfect metaphor. So if there's some problem with intoxication, which hurts the body and the mind, should dry out. Literally, vishoshanam means drying out. Because not necessarily in the sense of giving up alcohol. But here, it means discipline. It actually turns out to be quite a good metaphor. Vishoshanam literally means drying out, and it's a word that points to discipline, tapas. Just as drying out in our metaphoric sense for the alcoholic, discipline, fighting against the addiction. And by the way, that is one nasty addiction. Please don't assume it's a weak character that causes people to get addicted to alcohol or any substance. Some people have there's a lot of science on this now. Some people have a genetic predisposition to addictive behaviors. This is science. So it's not a weakness of character. There is, many times it's in a family. You may have noticed that. If a father is an alcoholic, it gets passed on through the generations. Anyway, a side issue. But many people wrongly conclude, oh, the person isn't trying hard enough. It's a bad, weak character. There is a genetic predisposition to addictive behaviors. they're still over. That's not an excuse by any means. You still have to put in the effort to come out of it. Tremendous effort to come out of it. So that is our drying out. So vishoshanam, drying out. Discipline of the physical body and of the subtle body. Physical body would bring us to tapas like fasting. Subtle body would bring us to practices like meditation. These disciplines of the body and mind. Now jump up to the third line. Sharirari tapaha kuryat. Kuryat, you should do. We skipped a word in a prior verse, which was yasmat, because you have these impediments, therefore kuryat, you should deal with them. Deal with the impediments, remove the impediments. How do you remove the impediments? Sharirari tapaha, through tapas, in both senses, in the sense of removing bad karma by willfully undergoing suffering, and in my interpretation as putting in the hard work, the discipline, the effort, and that discipline and effort is for the shariradi. Sharira means with regard to the body, with regard to the physical body, you do fasting, etc. With regard to the subtle body, you do meditation. By the way, there's a nice connection between the two. Fasting is to withdraw from food. Meditation is to withdraw from the world. Withdrawal involved in both of those. Two examples of tapas. And in this way, tad vishuddhartam. In uttamam, in this way, there is tad vishuddh, that tad represents mind. There is vishuddhi artam. It is, arta here means for the sake of. It is for the sake of the vishuddhi, the complete purification tat of the mind, of the chitta, is accomplished, and here Shankara adds an adjective, uttamam, the highest, the best means for this, for removing these impediments is basically everything we've been talking about, which he summarizes with the words tapas, discipline of the physical body and of the mind, both. Excuse me. So, with that verse, we come to the end of a topic, and we're about to begin a completely different topic. It would be so nice if there were chapters in these chapters, subheadings, that's a modern convention. For what, I don't know why, but it wasn't practiced in ancient times. I guess they presumed that if you're studying this text, you're smart enough to figure out where a new topic begins. But to be honest, it's not always so easy to see when those chapter demarcations occur. Our modern practice of putting subtitles and getting a context. Not subtitles. Subtitles is for videos. Same both. I just realized. Subtitle, you have a title, you have a subtitle. But then we also use subtitles for caption that you might have on a video. Anyway, not in the sense of caption. You have a main title, you have a subtitle. They would be very helpful. So let us put in a subtitle right here. New topic. New topic is how avidya and maya are similar. Avidya, ignorance. Maya, not exactly ignorance. How they are similar. And I don't want to talk about how they're similar yet. I think it'll come in next week's class. So we're going to talk, Shankara here starts off talking about avidya, and then very deftly shifts from avidya, ignorance, to maya. We'll discuss that much more in the next class. We're going to start off today. I think we can see these two verses dealing with ignorance. And ignorance in a very specific manner, in a very fundamental manner, in a very Vedantic manner. And let me just give the introduction. And ignorance in a very fundamental manner is this. Your true nature is Satchidananda Atma, which is unchanging consciousness. Unchanging is a very important word in our context. You are the unchanging observer of constantly changing experiences. If you really get that, you are 90% of the way to the end of the road. That's such an important recognition, that you are the unchanging observer of constantly changing experiences. So that's such an important teaching Shankara gives. And that truth is not understood. It's not fully recognized. You understand it conceptually. Yes, consciousness must necessarily be the unchanging witness of these changing conditions of mind. If consciousness changed along with the mind, you've heard this argument many times, if consciousness changed along with the mind, you wouldn't detect the changes in your mind. We've had this argument before. You get it conceptually. All of you get it conceptually because we've talked about this many times. But for most people, it stays conceptual. You don't see yourself as the unchanging observer. You see yourself as subject to change, like getting happy or sad. You don't get happy or sad. Happiness and sadness arises in your mind. You observe the happiness and sadness arising in the mind. These few sentences are enough to make my point. It's only understood conceptually for most people. Satchidananda Atma is the unchanging revealer of the constantly changing activities of the mind. All of that is absolutely correct. But it's not enough. Because we're not talking about Satchidananda here, we're talking about you in your essential nature. You are the unchanging observer of the constantly changing activities of your mind. The fact that you don't get it at a personal level demonstrates the continued presence of ignorance, which is our next topic here. Drishtam jagaritam vidyat, drishtam jagaritam vidyat, smritam svapnam tadevatu, smritam svapnam tadevatu, sushuptam tarabhavam cha, sushuptam tarabhavam cha, swatmanam swamatmanam param param, swamatmanam param param. Our common topic of three states of experience, the constantly changing experiences of your life, can be put into three categories. Experiences you're having when you're awake, like right now, experiences you have in a dream, like you did last night, and experience, or I should say the lack of experience, when you have dreamless sleep. These are our three states: Jagrat, Swapna, and Sushupti. Very quickly, Shankara summarizes them in one verse. He says, Jagratam vidyat, you should understand the waking state to be a state of drishtam, when you experience the world. Drishtam literally means seen. And here it refers to experiencing the world outside, as opposed to dream state. Swapnam tadeva tu, but the state we call swapna, dream, is a state in which you experience what is smritam, remembered. Drishtam, literally seen, but experienced of the world around you. Smritam, remembered. Your dreams are made mostly of your, what do you say, your waking experiences rehashed, as it were. Put in the mixie, mix it up, whatever comes out. It's usually very entertaining and different. Anyway. So that is waking state is based on your experience of the world. Dream state is based on your memories, impressions of what you experience when you're awake. And the state of deep sleep, sushupti, is tad abhavam. Tad means tayoho, of those two. It is the absence of those two, the absence of the waking state and dream state. The absence of waking state experiences and dream state experiences. So deep sleep is a state in which there are no waking or dream experiences. We can say it is the experience of nothing. Of course, that leads into a big argument, which we're going to very conveniently gloss over. How do you experience nothing? We can talk about that for a long time. That's not our topic here. So, deep sleep is the absence of those two. Shankara simply establishes these three states of experience, which constantly alternate every day and night. We go through these three changing states of experience, but swam atmanam, your own true self, swam, one's own, atmanam, true self, is param param. It is the ultimate param. I hesitate to use the word state because, as we've discussed here before, Atma has no states. Mind undergoes these three states of experience. Atma has no state. Therefore, let's translate padam not as state, but the reality because of which these three states exist. Now, you've understood that, as I said in the introduction here, understood it conceptually, but it may still not be your personal reality. You find yourself subject to change. Mind goes up, you go up. Mind goes down, you go down. Like the stock market. People watch the market and their moods go up and down with the stock market. Lots of ignorance there. And now Shankara talks about that particular ignorance. Sushuptap kyam tamo jnanam. Sushuptap kyam tamo jnanam. Bijam swapna prabodhayoho. Bijam swapna prabodhayoho. Swatma bodha pradagdam syat. Swatma bodha pradagdam syat. Bijam dagdham yatha bhavam. Bijam dagdham yatha bhavam. Sushupta akhyam, that which we call deep sleep, is tamas, darkness, and it is a condition of ajnanam, condition of ignorance, a condition of not knowing. This is a particular teaching methodology employed in Advaita Vedanta to help us understand what is ignorance. Generally, in a philosophical sense, we say ignorance is the absence of knowledge. But in Advaita Vedanta, it's helpful to introduce this metaphor of ignorance being like a veil, a covering, that which covers your true self. And the reason we use that metaphor of veil is this: your true self is already present, but not fully recognized. How to explain that? It's difficult to explain that just by the absence of knowledge. So we introduced this metaphor. It is as though there is a semi-transparent veil obscuring your true self. You know that you are conscious, a conscious being, but you fail to know the true nature of that conscious being that you are. So we then call this ignorance, we compare it to darkness. By the way, also in pre-scientific times, darkness was considered to be a covering. Only in modern times do we know that light is... Who in ancient times do you think anyone could figure out that light is particles, packets of energy called photons? Could they have comprehended that? Light is packets of energy called photons? We ourselves, modern people, we didn't understand that till 1920s. And we have Dr. Einstein, who used to teach down the road at Princeton. We have Dr. Einstein to thank for that. We didn't figure it out until the 1920s. That light is particles of photon. So not surprisingly, they didn't understand that in ancient times. They thought that you have to get rid of the darkness. Light is something that destroys darkness. This is the ancient pre-scientific worldview, which we also had until 1920. So light is some kind of thing that destroys darkness. And that is a metaphor for knowledge destroys the veil of ignorance. Like lightness, what is that? like light destroys darkness, knowledge destroys the so-called veil of ignorance. Therefore, in sushupti, in deep sleep, you are stuck with that veil of ignorance, which is tamas, a kind of darkness. Consider this. In deep sleep, all of the problems of your mind are gone. We just talked about obstacles. Those obstacles in your mind. You remove all those obstacles in deep sleep, they're all gone. What is present in deep sleep is you. So in deep sleep, do you become enlightened? Well, there's something else present in deep sleep in addition to you. In deep sleep, you are present as a conscious being, freed from the impediments of the mind. Something else is also present in deep sleep: ignorance. Otherwise, you'd be enlightened. And you'd discover your true self every time you had sound sleep. That doesn't take place. So, sushupta-khyam, that which we call sushupti, deep sleep, is tamas. It's like a veil. It's a jnanam, veil of ignorance. And here now, Shankara is starting to shift our discussion from ignorance to maya. Because he calls this state of deep sleep, this ignorance, he calls it the bijam, the seed for swapna and prabodha. Swapna, obvious dream. Prabodha means here waking state. Now it can mean enlightenment in context. Prabodha means waking state. So the bijam, the seed for the dream and waking state, is deep sleep. And you can think of it like this. From the state of deep sleep, you wake up halfway. Dream. From the state of deep sleep, you wake up
all the way, waking state. So in this sense, we can understand that the state of deep sleep, and it is a state, right? These are three states of the mind. Atma has no state. Our minds do have these three states: deep sleep, dream, and waking. So you wake up halfway into a dream world. That dream world is created when you wake up halfway. In that sense, where did that dream world come from? What was the metaphoric seed that gave rise to the dream world? The metaphoric seed was deep sleep, tamas. Some connection I'm not getting. What is the connection? There is some poet, you made a connection, it's not coming, a connection calling darkness was fertile. Fertile darkness. Out of darkness comes anything and everything. There's some poetic expression, I'm just not able to get it. Anyway, that's our topic though. Out of that darkness of deep sleep arises your dream world, and out of that darkness of deep sleep arises this world when you wake up. In this sense, both the dream state and the waking state have the deep sleep state as their seed. That seed germinates, so to speak, and gives rise to waking state experiences and dream state experiences. This idea of bijam, seed, is being introduced here to set us up for the next verse, in which we're going to shift our attention to Maya. We'll save that for next week. Let's just stay with ignorance for right now. So understand this ignorance to be like a seed. It's a metaphor. We love metaphors, don't we? We meaning Vedantins. In the study of Vedanta, there's such extensive use of metaphor. Thank goodness. If it weren't for these metaphors, this stuff would be a whole lot harder to grasp. What do they say? A picture is like 1,000 words. Metaphors are like conceptual pictures. They're not drawn pictures, they're like idea pictures, conceptual pictures. So if a picture is worth 1,000 words, a metaphor is worth 1,000 ideas. I don't know, something like that. You make it up. So this bija, this seed, is a metaphor for ignorance. And this is a perfect place to end our class. Because we'll see the second half of this verse in the next class, but this is perfect. So think of this. We generally think of ignorance. Let me make this point. In Western philosophy, ignorance is an absence of knowledge. But in Advaita Vedanta, it's so helpful to look at ignorance as a presence. Just as they looked up, and in ancient times, darkness was like a covering which had to be removed by light. Again, that's pre-scientific, fine, but this is the metaphor. We have to understand these teachings, we have to adopt a pre-scientific worldview. Darkness is a covering which has to be removed. Ignorance, like that darkness, is a covering. It is a veil. And a veil here which partially obscures, as I said before, you know you are a conscious being. You don't know the full extent of that consciousness. In particular, you don't know that that consciousness is unchanging. We
generally take ourselves to be, I am a conscious being, and I am subject to being affected by events in my life. Right? That's a common notion. I am a conscious being. You have partial knowledge. I am a conscious being. I am sat chit. Conscious, chit. Being, sat. That's what the words mean. Chit means consciousness. Sat means existent. I am sat chit. But because you don't recognize that your consciousness is unchanging, utterly unaffected by events in your life, the ananda part gets left out. The ananda part isn't recognized, and instead there's a lot of suffering and struggle. So we have to remove that veil of ignorance so that you don't merely know that you are sat-chit, a conscious being, but that you know you are sat-chit ananda, a conscious being who is unchanging and therefore utterly untouched, unaffected by suffering. So we'll see more of that in the next class. Om sarve bhavantu sukhinah, sarve santu niramayah, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, ma kashchid dukha bhag bhavet, asato ma sadgamaya, ma jyotirgamaya, mrityorma amritangamaya. Om shanti shanti shanti. Om tat sat.
All right.